This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm really happy that you're part of our day and that we're part of yours. So let's get to it. Now, if you've been following recent media coverage about Afghanistan, then you've probably encountered headlines like these.
We can't make a country care about its own women. Only Afghanistan can do that. USA Today, August 16th.
The nightmare resumes for Afghan women. America rescued them 20 years ago. How can we abandon them to the Taliban again? The Wall Street Journal, August 17th.
Afghan women fear the worst, whether war or peace lies ahead. Whatever happens once the United States withdraws will not bode well for Afghan women.
And you can hear these same sentiments in broadcast media.
Much to the Taliban's consternation, one of the great victories of the past two decades has been the education and the limited advance in freedom for Afghan women and girls. That era appears to be over.
But many women in Kabul haven't even left their homes out of fear. Under the previous Taliban rule, women in many cases were not allowed to go to school. They had to have their full body covered, and they needed guardians to accompany them in the streets.
And all of it should sound very familiar because the American media had a lot to say about Afghan women 20 years ago. Here's a 60 Minutes report from October of 2001.
For the women of Afghanistan, the veil, the burqa, has become the symbol of the Taliban's power. Even women who fled to the United States have been afraid to remove that veil of repression, fearing reprisals on their family back home and from Taliban supporters here in America.
And in the intervening years, American media occasionally checked in on the women of Afghanistan, especially when doing so included the opportunity to interview a high-profile guest. Take a listen to Today Show co-host Savannah Guthrie during a 2016 segment with former First Lady Laura Bush.
Former First Lady Laura Bush, she's here to talk about a new book called We Are Afghan Women, Voices of Hope. She wrote the introduction and launched the efforts to get it published. The book includes Afghan women's accounts of their successes, their triumphs, despite great adversity there. It's a topic that Mrs. Bush has been fiercely passionate about.
Now be clear, it is not fake news to claim that Taliban governance is devastating for women's lives and futures. But it is misleading reporting to hint that this is a consequence of Islam rather than the result of the Taliban's totalitarianism. And it's not fake news to claim that women have enjoyed more professional opportunities and access to the public sphere during the past 20 years. But it is deeply inadequate to report this while failing to note that the repression of Afghan girls and women coincided with U.S. intervention 50 years ago during the Soviet-Afghan War. And it's almost irresponsible to ignore that the economic devastation and violence connected to America's post-9/11 invasion fell disproportionately on Afghanistan's women and girls. It's not fake news to say many Americans are concerned with the fate and future of Afghan women, but it is startling to report this while ignoring generations of Afghan women who have organized on their own behalf. So, the takeaway. As a media outlet reporting at this time of American-initiated chaos in Afghanistan, we're going to begin today by asking, how can we do better? And here to discuss this is Amani Al-Kataba, who is founder of Muslim Girl, an organization working to normalize the word Muslim for both Muslims and non-Muslims alike. Welcome, Amani.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm happy to be here.
And Rafia Zakaria, who is the author of the new book, Against White Feminism. Welcome, Rafia.
Thank you for having me.
Amani, let me start with you. A recent tweet of yours read, after over a decade of our tireless work to push back against the stereotype that, quote, Islam oppresses women, here go the Taliban once again bastardizing my religion and reigniting the white savior complex that got us into this mess. Expand.
Yes. I mean, for me, 9/11 happened when I was a child. And of course, I, from a very young age, was bombarded by a lot of the media misrepresentation of our wars abroad in Muslim countries, from being political wars to being contorted into being humanitarian ones, quote unquote, on the pretense of liberating Muslim women, giving them their freedom, going in to save brown girls and women from brown men. And obviously, all of these elements have played into a very problematic atmosphere that has resulted in life or death situations, not only for the populations being devastated by U.S. intervention overseas, but also for Muslims around the world that now have had to push back against the disempowerment of this Western lens that we need outside intervention in order to be rescued, in order to be saved. And we clearly see now, you know, hindsight is 2020, that those policies absolutely devastated women and girls disproportionately more than anybody.
Indeed. In fact, Rafi, I'm just going to ask you to pick up there at the end of where Imani has brought us to this idea that we begin in this moment of 9/11, but actually not just beginning there, right? Going back before that moment in the ways that the political interests of the U.S. had these devastating effects.
Yes, you're right. The fact is that the way these women are being portrayed, Muslim women, Afghan women, has very little to do about the women, those women themselves, and everything to do with positioning the white American woman as feminist in chief. So if you want, you know, the white American woman to look at, you know, to present this front of being feminist in chief, well, it helps to have these quote unquote other women for that feminist in chief to save. So over the course of the war on terror, you've seen not only the elevation of white women in that role, but then now repeatedly in the media coverage, as you pointed out in your introduction, there is this idea that as long as white people were there in Afghanistan, they were somehow protecting Afghan women. While, and so now that they're leaving, there's no one to protect Afghan women. So there's a very pointed attack on that culture there, which says that this culture is inherently unfeminist. It has a very particular, pointed attack on women in a way that American culture does not. So, there's a whole ongoing discourse here of, now positioning American feminism as another offshoot of American exceptionalism, where, what Jessica Chastain did in Zero Dark 30, you know, the white American woman is out there to go save the world by torturing brown men. And so all of that is part of this discourse, and you see it reemerge, in this sort of 5 minutes that America has allotted to Afghanistan after ignoring it for decades. And of course, by next week, it'll be forgotten again.
I so appreciate, I'm sorry, you heard my my call and response there to what feels like so much truth that you are telling us. And I have to say, as currently a working member of the US media, like, I get the ways that the news cycle pushes and drives us, and that we're always trying to find a story and report it and report it well. But this one, the consequences and the length of time that we've been telling this same narrative, Imani, I want to come to you because, you know, part of what's happening here, from my perspective, is the ways that you intervened, you and other particularly millennial and Z generation Muslim women intervened by making use of media in a very different way. Can you talk a little bit about the initial founding of Muslim Girl, which is now stunningly old? I mean, it's such an established institution now, but talk to me a little bit about that.
Absolutely. I mean, when I started Muslim Girl as a teenager, all we had available at our fingertips was social media and the resources that were provided to us through the internet. And in that way, we were able to really melt a lot of the borders on the conversations that we were having. Really, the intent of creating Muslim Girl was to create a platform where we can reclaim that narrative in the media as a new generation of Muslim women and girls that aren't here to say you know, this isn't the real Islam and, you know, this is what it, we really believe in, but rather to have the conversation on our terms. Because for the majority of my life, a lot of those, the conversations that you've been talking about, that that the media has been covering, a lot of the propaganda we saw from 20 years ago, and even some of the coverage that we see today, for the most part, always by non-Muslims, non-Afghans, non-Iraqis, people that don't come from the communities that are directly impacted. And a lot of the times, it's always been white women, and even more so white men, speaking on behalf of Muslim women in these populations and quote-unquote tribulations that they have to endure because of their religion. And of course, we know the very dire political impact that that narrative has created. I mean, this is what empowers so much of our ideology of American exceptionalism. You know, that these problems occur abroad, but they don't happen here. And we have to be, you know, like the global cop to be putting out these fires and going into other people's countries that aren't asking for that.
Amani, are you suggesting that there is gender inequity here in the United States?
Oh, as if that's such a radical assertion to make. And that's the problem, right? When we have these issues at home, for example, when domestic violence is the top killer of women, we call it domestic violence. When it happens in a Muslim country, we call it an honor killing. So even the way that we tell these stories, the way that we label them, is intended to continue othering them. So it's no surprise to me that the headlines that are re-erupting right now have suddenly taken on this moral discourse about how we have to save women and it's about their rights and stuff like that, when we all know that the United States government does not give a damn about brown girls or brown women.
Ravia, talk to me a little bit more about your concept of feminist in chief. It's such a powerful one that both sort of exposes something about feminism, but also about a certain kind of militarism and hierarchy. How, what does it mean to dismantle that?
Well, I mean, the essential issue here is white supremacy, which means that just as white feminists in the United States embraced carceral punishments to protect, to quote, demand protection from the state. So essentially, you know, we had the Violence Against Women Act, and the demand was of white feminists in the 60s and 70s that they wanted protection from domestic violence, which, I mean, sounds fantastic. But what ended up happening was that after the passage of the act, five times as many black men were arrested as white men. And, you know, you had this demand by white women for protection end up contributing to mass incarceration and increased rates of domestic violence against black women. So in the case of the war on terror, it was an embrace of the coercive power of the state to bomb other countries. The demand by Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, and even Gloria Steinem was that, oh, we want protection from terrorism. And so what they did is imagine that they could export white feminism, which, by which I mean a feminism very much inflected with racial privilege, to this other country, and then we'll be safe from terrorists. So in both of those cases, the core is this idea that feminists and the state are one and the same, and that to be a true feminist, you have to adopt this positioning towards towards men of other cultures. And in the Afghan case, of course, it is the quintessential saving brown women from brown men, which positions the white feminist, like I said before, as feminist in chief. And it's not just an issue of media coverage right now. It's also an issue of the fact that the women who created the narrative around Afghan women from the get-go were white American women. And, you know, there's story after story after story of a white woman reporting from Afghanistan, and this was repeated recently in many CNN segments, that show that focus on the heroism of the white woman in having chosen, having made the choice to go cover this story. And which, of course, again, positions the white feminist as the heroine of the story. And so Americans, in being sort of fed this propaganda in many, many different ways, have begun to, you know, have internalized it. The other issue is that if it were talked about in this way, then people would see essential and crucial connection between movements like Black Lives Matter in the United States and anti-imperial movements in places like Afghanistan, because the core is the same idea that everyone else has to sort of passively receive American policies, and the white American woman knows best what Afghan women need, what Pakistani women need, what women anywhere and everywhere need. And also the painting of the Afghan women as only valuable when they are somehow assisting the United States in demonizing Afghan men. So you have program after program, even now, even the UN is currently running programs under countering violent extremism, which essentially focus on training Muslim women to quote unquote be, you know, informers on their communities. Mm. And this happened here in, you know, domestically in the US as well. And there is no critique of that even now. And there's no critique of that from any political party. It's not just a Republican thing. It's also Democrats who are failing to do that.
Twenty years in Afghanistan, we cover precise. Over that, right? You know, five different administrations. Amani, give us an alternative vision. What is Muslim feminism for you?
I think that the most important thing that people need to understand is they have to listen to what these women have to say. And if we had did that 20 years ago, if we had listened to Afghan women, none of them were asking for US intervention. None of them were calling for American feminists to come rescue them. And the fact is that because we have spoken over their voices for so long, that we have created the situation for them. And now, yes, Afghan women are paying the ultimate price for the narratives and the rhetoric that we are putting out there from this side of the world. And that is so wrong and disruptive. And to imagine what future generations are going to have to continue healing from and rebuilding right after all of the incredible progress that was made in reaction to the first round of all of this, I think it's necessary for us to really use this as a moment to take a step back and pass the mic to the people that are directly impacted, allow them to represent and speak for themselves and lead us on what needs to be done for their benefit and for the best outcome for their futures.
Listen to Afghan women and believe Afghan women. Amani, Rafia, thank you both for discussing this extremely important topic with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris Perry. And a lot of you know that this big dramatic music is World of Warcraft. That is, if you're a gamer, if you play. I mean, this is the world-sized video game that's been a benchmark for years of the gaming world. But there's a tradition in gaming that's gone on for just as long and has a bigger impact. for years, women have faced sexual harassment and gender discrimination as both players of video games and as employees at the companies that make these games. You might remember the infamous Gamergate controversy of 2014, which involved an organized online harassment campaign of women in the gaming world. Brianna Wu was just one of the countless women targeted.
Within a few hours, they were sending me death threats. They published my address to the internet. You know, they threatened to do some extremely violent things to me.
It's been 7 years since Gamergate, and not much has changed. Toxic gaming culture is back in the spotlight once again after the state of California filed a lawsuit against the gaming giant Activision Blizzard in late July. That's the company behind wildly popular games like Candy Crush, World of Warcraft, Guitar Hero, Call of Duty, and more. Could this lawsuit mean game over for Activision Blizzard and toxic gaming culture overall? To answer that and more, we're joined by Nicole Carpenter, a senior reporter at Polygon. Nicole, thanks for being here.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the company at the center of this lawsuit, Activision Blizzard. What's its reputation?
So Activision Blizzard is one of the biggest and most popular and most kind of beloved video game companies for the games that it has put out over the years. And so this lawsuit coming forward in July has kind of changed how the company is viewed now. There have been some problems over the years that have been reported on, but this lawsuit kind of just opened up the company to a lot of really, really damning allegations that hadn't been discussed before.
And what are some of those allegations?
Basically, the lawsuit is targeting Activision Blizzard for discriminating against female employees and also sort of widespread sexual harassment. And the allegations there kind of are spread along those lines. Basically, the allegations are going back quite far as well. So these allegations have been spread beyond just, you know, the past 2 years when this investigation had started.
So these are allegations that have existed for some time and are larger. Talk to me about how the lawsuit actually came to be.
So the lawsuit came to be after California's Department of Fair Employment and Housing had been investigating Activision Blizzard for about 2 years. And so they, over those 2 years, they had been talking to employees. They had sent out kind of a memo to current and former employees asking them, you know, hey, let's talk about your experience. And that's how they found out about a lot of the things that were discussed in the lawsuit. But the things discussed in the lawsuit also range back quite a number of years, you know, and that's an important part of the story as well. In the lawsuit, the majority of the allegations are targeting Blizzard Entertainment, which is kind of a subsidiary of Activision Blizzard King. A lot of the allegations are regarding that one portion of the company, but in speaking to workers in my own reporting, they've kind of wanted to make it clear that this sort of culture is ingrained throughout the company, and not only throughout the company, but throughout the video game industry as well.
So, Nicole, I got to tell you, I have been taking this very, like, personally, because I have a 7-year-old daughter who is absolutely obsessed with these games and describes herself as a gamer girl, does all the things that, like, my ex-gen brain can't understand in terms of sitting and watching other people play and all of these kinds of things. So just in the broadest sense, is it safe for girls in game culture?
I think that things are changing. You mentioned Gamergate. That period of time is still impacting the video game industry now. And then you see this kind of culture that has been going on behind the scenes as well. And that's kind of because this industry has for so long been accepted as a boys club. So this kind of, like, you know, in the lawsuit was described as frat boy culture. That sort of culture has been allowed to fester, but it is changing. And there are a ton of women and other marginalized people in this industry who are moving forward and kind of demanding change here. It's going to take time for kind of the leadership, the people who hold the power in this situation, to catch up to that, to listen to those people. But it is changing, and there are a ton of women in this industry who are advocating for change. And as you've seen from this lawsuit, and then the reporting that followed, people people are talking about this. People want this to come out, and they love this industry. They love the games that they make, and they want those games to be made ethically and without this kind of widespread sexual harassment.
So when you talk about the games that are made, I mean, some of them, like Call of Duty, have, you know, certainly come under public scrutiny for violence and that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. take something like Candy Crush. I mean, it crushed my heart to read that this company had these internal problems and made a game that I don't think it would be possible to get either of my children to stop playing. And I wouldn't even necessarily want them to stop. It's a great activity in the car when we're driving long distances. Is it possible for consumers to ethically impact this? In other words, do you see gamers as people who are like, you know what, no more Candy Crush for me if it's going to be a sexist, toxic work environment?
Some people in the gaming community are kind of boycotting these games. And like you mentioned, Candy Crush, that's a King product. But there is one game, Overwatch, from Blizzard Entertainment, that has kind of been renowned as a game that has had a diverse cast of characters. You know, there are women, there are men from other countries, you know, just widespread. It's a global game. And so, like, the cast is diverse, and it's been lauded for that. And then seeing what was going on behind the scenes, that's upset people. But the thing to remember, I think, is that the people working on these games are the ones that are pushing for this change and pushing for these additions to be put in. And so the workers right now at Activision Blizzard are not calling for people to boycott the game or boycott any of their games. They do have four demands that they're asking right now from leadership, but they're not asking for a boycott right now. So in my opinion, I think the best kind of way to move forward is to kind of follow the lead of the workers and go from there. I don't think a boycott is off the table. And if the workers kind of said, hey, this is what's going to get the attention of the company, then I think that moving forward from there, that is also an option.
You've talked about women in gaming being here, advocating, pushing. Are there women in leadership? And where there are women in leadership, does it make a difference?
You know, that's a tough question, because right now, one of the big controversies within this Activision lawsuit has been a response from one powerful woman in leadership, Fran Townsend, at Activision Blizzard. And workers at Activision Blizzard are devastated by the response that they had gotten from her internally. She sent out an internal memo that basically wrote off some of the complaints and kind of called the lawsuit distorted and not entirely true. And that's sort of what pushed the workers into this open letter and then later a walkout. So right now, we're seeing a woman in power, and workers are not happy with how that's going. So, you know, putting one woman in a powerful position is not going to change this structurally. But I think overall, having more marginalized people in those positions is a good thing and what will move the industry forward.
Nicole Carpenter is a senior reporter at Polygon. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for...
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Having me.
This is a takeaway from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
In the early 1960s, at the height of the civil rights movement, government officials in Alabama were prosecuting Martin Luther King Jr. on perjury charges. The New York Times published an ad asking for donations to defend Dr. King. The ad read, in part, quote, "As the whole world knows by now, thousands of Southern Negro students are engaged in widespread nonviolent demonstrations in positive affirmation of the right to live in human dignity as guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights." It went on to say, quote, "In their efforts to uphold these guarantees, they are being met by an unprecedented wave of terror." Well, Montgomery, Alabama Public Safety Commissioner L.B. Sullivan did not take kindly to these words, or to the minor factual inaccuracies that were also in the ad. He sued the New York Times and the African American ministers who placed the ad, suing them for libel. A state court in Alabama awarded Sullivan $500,000. But the Times appealed the decision all the way to the Supreme Court, where the ruling was overturned. Justice Brennan wrote for the unanimous court, arguing that in order for a media outlet to be held liable by a public official, their reporting must be motivated by, quote, actual malice. The decision is a key precedent protecting freedom of the press, but members of the current Supreme Court are reconsidering how it's being implemented. Just last month, Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote in a dissenting opinion, saying that it's time for the Supreme Court to take another look at the case. Despite saying he supported Sullivan when questioned about it by Senator Amy Klobuchar during his confirmation hearing in 2017.
Do you believe under New York Times v. Sullivan that the First Amendment would permit public officials to sue the media under any standard less demanding than actual malice? And can you explain to the people here today and those watching on TV what that standard means to you?
New York Times versus Sullivan was, as you say, a landmark decision. And it changed pretty dramatically the law of defamation and libel in this country. Rather than the common law of defamation and libel, applicable normally for a long time, the Supreme Court said the First Amendment has special meaning and protection when we're talking about the media, the press, in covering public officials, public actions, and indicated that a higher standard of proof was required in any defamation or libel claim. Proof of actual malice is required to state a claim. That's been the law of the land for, 50, 60 years.
So has Gorsuch had a change of heart, and does it pose a real threat to the landmark case? And what would overturning Sullivan mean for press freedom in this country? Here to discuss is Adam Liptak, who covers the United States Supreme Court for the New York Times. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Okay, so can you talk about actual malice? Why is this a particular standard?
So actual malice imposes a constitutional bar on libel cases, which until Sullivan had been governed by state law. And it says that not only do you have to have said something false and defamatory in the sense of harmful to reputation, you have to have more or less done it on purpose. The actual malice rule says the person suing for libel has to prove that the publisher of the statement made it knowing it to be false or with reckless disregard. And the court has said reckless disregard means with serious subjective doubts about the truth of the statement. So that's a lot of words. But the short of it is you have to prove that you did it on purpose. It can't just be a mistake. And that's very hard to do for two reasons. First of all, journalists don't generally lie. They may make mistakes, but they don't set out to say false things. But even if they did, it's very, very hard to come up with evidence that that happened, because that evidence is going to be almost entirely within the brain of the journalist. And it's very hard to prove whether someone said something false on purpose or not. So the actual malice rule sets up a really daunting hurdle for public officials. And that's part of the theory of the First Amendment, that speech about politics needs special protection so that there can be robust discussions among citizens about how they are to be governed.
So help us to understand how this decision has impacted press freedom in this country over the past 60 years.
Unlike much of the rest of the world, libel suits are really quite rare in the U.S. because they're so hard to win if you're subject to the actual malice rule, meaning that they tend not to be filed at all. And you hear people like former President Trump complaining that he can't sue and punish his critics because the libel law in the U.S. protects discussion of politics.
If Sullivan were to be reconsidered, overturned, what would that mean for sort of the landscape of media right now?
It would make libel suits much more common. It would subject the press to the threat and the reality of libel judgments. It would take us back into the era before Sullivan, where the New York Times actually withdrew its reporters from Alabama for a year because those libel judgments were so large that they threatened the very existence of the company. So it's hard to overstate how that could alter discussion of public affairs in the U.S., particularly in an era where the press is not nearly as economically powerful as it once was.
So, Adam, help me a little bit, though, because I feel like sometimes this may depend on where we're standing as we watch this, right? So this is a case decided in part around, you know, the protection of Martin Luther King Jr., right? And we're talking about the folks who are currently on the court who are talking about reversing it. It's also connected with, you know, the things that President Trump said during his time in office about wanting to open the case back up. But if we go to out to California and we look at the case of the former mayor of Stockton, Michael Tubbs, that's a case of someone who was running for re-election, and there was a sort of fake news site, right, that was posted that was, it was a website. It looked like it was news, but it was mostly just one of his opponents putting out a lot of false information about him. And it does seem that this same decision is protecting those individuals. So is there some possibility that there is a good that could be done for public information by rethinking Sullivan?
That's the point that Justices Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas have been making. If for sure the Sullivan case pushes the needle far in one direction in the protection of free speech at the expense of protection of reputation. And that's not the only place to put the needle, but that's where we've put it so far. What Justices Gorsuch and Thomas say is, as you were saying, Melissa, whatever was true in 1964, the information environment these days is full of lies and nonsense and disinformation. And giving that kind of information a shield from libel law may be bad for public discourse. Justice Gorsuch said that Sullivan was decided in an era where you had investigative reporters and copy editors and fact checkers in the establishment media, which guaranteed a certain level of quality. But now we live in an era of social media trolls and bots and disinformation, and maybe that requires, he says, a different legal regime.
What then is the counter argument on that? Because I got to say, I can understand why that would feel compelling, kind of across an ideological spectrum, that, okay, the media environment of 1964 is quite different than the media environment of 2021, and people do have a right to be protected from, what feels like sort of these self-serving, purposeful falsehoods about them, even if they are, in fact, public officials.
Well, so two things. The actual malice standard is hard, but it's not impossible to overcome. So if you can prove that someone lied about you on purpose and that person has some money and you can find them, you can win a libel judgment. But, I just laid out a bunch of caveats. The larger argument in the other direction is that the First Amendment represents a choice. And that choice is that we'll have a robust public discussion in which a lot of speech will take place, and we'll rely on citizens to use their critical faculties to make sense of what's true and what's not, and not the blunt instrument of libel suits.
So this is sort of the foundational democracy as the marketplace of ideas. And sometimes people will buy the wrong items at the marketplace, right? But having more happening in that marketplace of ideas is kind of the longer term good.
Right. So that's one theory of the First Amendment. You can also argue the opposite, that this marketplace is broken and needs regulation, and that maybe even defamation law is the right way to regulate it.
So I'm wondering, is there an actual case before the court right now? Why did this emerge in Gorsuch's writing?
So a couple of cases recently in 2019 and then just last month reached the court. The court turned down the cases, but in the process, one or two justices wrote that they'd love to take a whack at this issue and invited further cases to come to the court. So libel cases arrive at the Supreme Court with some regularity. It won't be hard for the court, if it wants to take up this case. At the moment, we know there are two votes to take it up. It takes four votes to add a case to the Supreme Court's docket, and of course, five votes to reverse the precedent. So we're nothing like all the way there. But you would have thought that this is one of the handful of really famous precedents that would be quite secure, I would have said just a few years ago. And now I'm less confident in that. And of course, this is a Supreme Court that is not shy about reconsidering precedents. This fall, it's going to take another look at Roe v. Wade.
Is Brown v. Board one they might look at?
No, I think Brown v. Board is the most secure. Everyone on the court agrees that it's the court's greatest achievement. And boy, I hope that the day doesn't come when people talk about overruling Brown against Board of Education.
Absolutely. One last question here. So we know that Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch have signaled publicly their willingness to reconsider Sullivan. What about the other justices on the court?
The only other justice who's expressed some qualms about Sullivan in her academic writing before she joined the court, and only about an aspect of Sullivan, was Justice Elena Kagan, who didn't seem to have a problem with the part of Sullivan we've been talking about. But later cases extended Sullivan from government officials to so-called public figures, celebrities, people caught up in public controversies. And she has wondered in her academic writing whether that step of taking it out of the realm of politics and into just discussions of public affairs generally is an appropriate use of the Sullivan decision.
So protect the mayors, but maybe not the Kardashians. Got it. Adam Liptak covers the United States Supreme Court for the New York Times. Adam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Really fun to be here.
Okay, folks, that's Thursday. What a concept. And speaking of concepts, we've been looking for audio slices of your life. We've been asking you to record voice memos of a snippet of your life and the sound it's making. Well, we got a buzzy one from Cecilia in California. Cecilia wrote to us, "This very short video of a bee pollinating my blueberries comes with the soundtrack of my life and environment. I live in El Dorado County. As you can hear by the sound, nature is surviving the noise of commerce. Wishing you joy." Well, thanks, Cecilia, and same back to you. And check this one out. Oh, too cute. This is from Liz in New Jersey. And she writes, "This is a day at the beach with my 16-month-old Alma. She's an active talker. And these are some of her current favorite sounds to make. Oh, sounds that bring so much joy to my day." Oh, yes. And to ours as well. And then here's one more from Elizabeth, who sent us this. And she writes, "Here's the sound of my 14-year-old son whistling. He was cleaning his desk, just taking his time as he started to prepare for high school as a freshman." Oh, I love it. Keep these coming. Send us a voice recording or voice memo at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for spending some of your day with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Talk with you tomorrow.